Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Ashley Green, the founder of Instratify, a consulting and training company, and we're going to talk about organic growth for SaaS companies. This episode is brought to you by Jamfnow. Jamfnow helps businesses manage Apple devices in the workplace. It makes managing and securing every work iPhone, iPad, and Mac easier than ever. See the power of Jamfnow for yourself. Create an account today at jamf.com/UIbreakfast and start managing your first three devices for free. That's jamf.com/UIbreakfast. Hey, Ashley.
Hey, Jane. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here. I've been listening up a storm on your podcast lately, and I'm like in love with almost every episode you do. So I'm honored to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. We're thrilled to have you and your insights here. How about we start with a quick Bliss questionnaire and then go back to the main topic? How does it sound?
That sounds perfect.
Fantastic. And question number one is, what do you do for a living?
So, you kind of intro'd me already, but I am the CEO and founder of Instratify, which is a customer engineering consulting and training company.
Whoa, that was short. Any kind of details? What do you do?
Okay. You want the meal, full meal deal. So Instratify basically centers around organic growth and customer engineering, which Jane already mentioned. And basically what that means is focusing on sustainable growth. You hear a lot about growth hacking these days, and it's incredibly important, and especially the process behind it, but you don't hear as much about organic growth, and in particular that process in terms of customer insights, which is actually the biggest driver of any unicorn-type growth that we all admire from companies like Facebook. So I'm lucky enough to get to work with founders, entrepreneurs, as well as accelerators, and get them to help them focus on sustainable growth. And I do that through consulting on projects. Used to do a lot of growth coaching as well, and a lot of training.
Wonderful. Tell us a bit about your background story. I know you're a lawyer by training.
Yes, I am a lawyer by training. So I think I have a spiral staircase story with a very varied background, like I think everyone these days does. So I did finance, actually, originally. I did an undergraduate business degree, and I did finance and marketing. And I almost went down the iBanking route, and I did all the Bay Street interviews. I'm in Canada, so that's Canada's Wall Street. And I was like, nope, this isn't for me. And I ended up working in marketing a little bit after that before I ultimately went to law school. And I was fortunate enough in law school to have my old employer ask me to stay on as a consultant. So I was consulting all throughout law school. I got to work on some big Fortune 500 type projects. I did a lot of digital strategy work in media and entertainment. And while I was doing that and law school, I also got involved with a side project in the tech space. So I ultimately, yeah, so not enough on my plate. The first 2 years of law school, I have to say, I did not get to enjoy the social aspect as much as I would have liked. It was pretty busy, but a crazy, crazy good type of busy. And so I decided I actually not going to practice law at all. I'd always been an entrepreneur, and I kind of knew that's ultimately where I was going to be, but I've always felt I was on this conveyor belt. You know, good girls do become doctors, or they become lawyers. So that was always the path that I was on. So even before I did finance, I did biochemistry for a while because I was going down that doctor path, which is what I was supposed to do. That is what a good, smart girl does. So I always, in the back of my mind, I'd always loved organizing things and starting things, but I never really realized that being an entrepreneur was something that I could actually do, you know, younger, not when I'm 50 or 60 years old. So I, again, was on that path, and I realized halfway through law school that I was going to get off that path, which was incredibly scary from someone who's always done the right thing or what they were supposed to do or what I should have said, the should game, what you should do. So that was pretty scary for me, but it's turned out, you know, pretty well. I had a minor relapse in terms of I almost went into the big three consulting thing for a while, but I stayed true to my entrepreneur ground, and I'm so happy I did. And I've been consulting ever since law school, and ultimately The first company I had was focused on digital strategy. So InStratify is my second consulting company, actually, where I basically melded the best of digital strategy work with my training as a lawyer, which is the real emphasis on contextual analysis, of course, getting into your opponent's heads, which I apply to customer engineering and customer-driven growth and organic growth.
That is a magical story. What does your typical day look like?
So I can't help myself here. I want to say there's no typical day, and I'm sure everyone, in fact, I heard lots of people in your podcast say that. But to be realistic, there are definitely patterns. That's what I do. I'm a trained pattern recognizer. So definitely there's patterns. So a typical day, so it depends on the day of the week. I've tried to be more productive in terms of organizing my time. I'm getting better at it. I don't always stick to my boundaries, but this is generally what I do. So Mondays are days for Ashley and InStratify and for me to work on the business. For those of you who've read the E-Myth, that's time for me to work on the business, not in the business. Tuesdays and Thursdays are generally when I do client calls, coaching sessions, advisory sessions, and any type of in-depth or execution-oriented client work. Wednesdays, I am fortunate enough to be affiliated with a lot of great accelerators. I do a lot of programming, training, one-on-ones with accelerators. So typically, I leave Wednesdays open for that, as well as to do things like podcasts and things like that. And then Friday is a day that I try to do administrative work for my business, whatever needs to get done, and whatever leftover time I have. Is when I do extra more in the business, sorry, on the business, not in the business work, whether that's speaking or writing or organizing a team and doing things like that. And generally, as much as I can, I try to save the mornings for my deep thinking and creating content and creating theories and frameworks, because I definitely work best early in the morning.
So you are a morning person.
I am not like a super early morning person. I feel like you have the picture of me up at 6 a.m. the crack of dawn. I'm more like a get up at 8 a.m. type person, and like from 9 to 12 is when I'm most productive. So I'm like an in-between morning person, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and one good technique everybody can borrow is piling up similar calls into, you know, a few days of the week, not spreading them out. I use that a lot too.
Yeah, no, I find that's been a game changer in terms of productivity for me, is to kind of couple all of those things on Tuesdays and Thursdays as much as I can. I allow like a break in between them, of course, because I need to digest and switch gears and all of that. So I do allow for like an hour break in between calls usually. Mm-hmm. But that's been a game changer, and just trying to organize and guard the time that I know that I'm at my best to do the most important work first. Not the most urgent, but the most important. The important versus the urgent is another thing that I struggle with, and I know other people struggle with too. So it's something I continually try to get better at. But I highly recommend doing that, figuring out whatever time of day works best for you. And that's when you work on the important, not the urgent.
What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
So in terms of most, do you mean about being an entrepreneur or about InStratify in general, or both?
Probably about your client work, but you can go in any of the directions.
Sure. Okay, so maybe I'll cover it in both. So for being an entrepreneur, what I like most is that I get to control my own destiny. I'm making a hand gesture that you can't see because we're doing a podcast. I'm a little bit of a control freak. So I just have like a little. So getting to control my own destiny and being off that conveyor belt at first was the scariest thing of all, because I've always been ingrained to certain KPIs for success, personally and professionally. But now that I get to control my own destiny, that is the thing I like most. And in terms of my client work, as corny as it is, and it is, because I am not saving the world, I am not Mother Teresa, I'm not doing Doctors Without Borders, is I truly like when I get to help people. Like entrepreneurs, founders, C-level executives, we suffer from, you know, in terms of like mental illness, all of those things higher than almost any other profession, probably except for lawyers. So if anyone's thinking about going to being a lawyer, I don't know, come talk to me about that. But actually being able to help someone, like if I'm able to say like, nope, that's not the right thing, you need to do this, and their face lights up and they're like, that is what I've been searching for and driving myself crazy on, and they go do it and they come back and they're like, yes, that changed it for me. That's what I love. I love those moments.
What about the least part?
I think the least part for me, as I've spent a lot of, I'm really interested in personal development. So the last 6 months, I've spent a lot of time focusing on that. I actually just joined Zen Tribes, a new group that Sherry Walling, Dr. Sherry Walling from Zen Founder, had put together.
Oh, congratulations. Yeah. How is it working out?
It's really good. I wasn't so sure about it because I'm a very, you know, I've been hit and miss on the mastermind type of concept. And this was even a different kind of mastermind, but I highly recommend it. I really enjoyed it. And some of the things that Sherry had sent to us were about, you know, all these different kind of assessments beyond like standard Myers-Briggs or anything like that. And so it really, just that process of self-discovery was great. And, I prudence, careful thinking, theorizing are also my strengths. So the part that I sometimes hate the least is sometimes the unstructured nature of being a coach. That was just the nature of that. I love the actual coaching, but sometimes the unstructuredness drives my structured brain a little bit crazy.
What is your next big thing?
My next big thing, I guess, well, I'm super passionate about organic growth, and I put a nice fancy name on it called customer engineering. So, spreading the word on that. I'm also working on a book called Humanizing Business, The Secret to Silicon Valley Rapid Growth.
So oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so finishing that will be a big thing, and then there's everything that goes with that, but first I need to get it finished. But yeah, there's a lot of attention on growth hacking, and I get asked to go for coffees, and people want to know, how do I make my Facebook ads work better? What do I do for this A/B test? And that's what people are really excited about. But truly, if you dig beneath the surface, what they want is they want that Silicon Valley rapid growth. They want to be the next unicorn. And if you look at the unicorns, every single one of them, their sustainable growth was driven by organic growth. And that's where sustainable growth is how you get to be a unicorn and stay a unicorn, most importantly. So spreading the word on that is something I'm super excited about because I don't think enough people are paying attention to it.
Absolutely. Is there a link that I can share about the book?
No, but I should create one.
All right. We'll just remember that you're making a book and everyone can sign up on your list later.
Yes, exactly. Well, maybe by the time this comes out, I can create a little landing page. So let's say it's www.instratify.co/humanizingbusiness. And I'll put up a little landing page there so people can get a sneak preview. And I welcome any comments or feedback or questions.
Wonderful. Now let's talk about our main topic, organic growth. You already made a very nice pitch like a minute ago about it. So we're all about everyone wants some hacks. Everyone wants, quick activities they can do to somehow supercharge this very slow organic process. While what you should be doing is kind of optimizing for slow and natural growth, right?
Yeah, and it's not even necessarily slow growth. It's sustainable growth. I think sustainable growth is the best word because all the tricks in the world and tactics, the decay rate on how long those are going to work, if they work at all, is very short. So while they might give you quick boosts, they're not going to last. What lasts, though, is having happy customers that are loyal and increasing the number of happy, loyal customers you have and increasing the level of happiness and loyalty because that directly corresponds with high organic growth. And organic growth obviously includes word of mouth and different types of word of mouth growth, but also includes virality or engineered virality, any of those types of things, as well as just working within your product to deliver the best experience. Again, coming back to your biggest driver of growth for almost any of the unicorn companies that I'm sure everyone listening to would love to have under their hands is going to be that organic word of mouth growth. And that's engineered by having happy, loyal customers.
So if in the traditional, for example, ad-driven model, you get together every month or two, you pump up, large budget, pump it into some ads and wait for a return. When you're tuned for the organic growth, what kind of activities can you do to actually fuel it?
So let's say to break that down into two parts. So I think first part, is if you're looking at organic growth, you're looking at ways I basically call organic growth while I concentrate on word of mouth type growth, or in some instances virality or engineered virality or all of that. It really means, as we all know, traffic and noise and all of those things are becoming harder and harder at the top of funnel. So basically anything below top of funnel to make your top of funnel more effective. So that would be the first part. And the second part would be measuring customer loyalty and happiness, and then using those insights to make everything else you do better. So taking the first route there, below top of funnel, I would say is ads, is spending money and playing with your ads the best thing you could be doing right now? Do you have an activation problem? Do you have an onboarding problem? So it'd be really laying out that whole customer journey and looking where, because everyone's resource constrained. Even if you're Facebook, you're resource constrained. You have a ton of resources, but you're resource constrained. You can't do everything that you want. And if you're a smaller company, you're severely resource constrained. So your biggest way to de-risk your company is to find the most efficient allocation of your resources, which isn't just money, but also your labor, your human capital. So to do that, that'd be my first question is, can we leave our ads alone? Are they performing well enough conversion rates that we can actually get a bigger gain down the funnel by working on something else, whether that's referral or revenue, monetization, retention, activation rates? And this is just a typical, SaaS funnel, according to Dave McClure, Pirate Metrics. So that'd be my first question, is ads what we need to be focusing on at all? Should we be taking the attention off, let the ads go, because we still need some top of funnel? Let's assume these ads are contributing decently to top of funnel. Is that what we should be paying attention to? So let's assume that we still need to pay some attention to the ads in the short term. Then the second thing I'd do is, how can we make our ads more effective? And that's when I would dig into this whole customer insight piece of organic growth or customer engineering, which helps you make increased conversions on everything because you're learning so much more about your customer. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. But now we all would like to learn actual activities involved into that.
Yeah. So maybe I should explain kind of my customer engineering process and theory. But basically, mm-hmm. there's three parts to that. And I'll do this super quickly so we can get into some actionable stuffs. One is the whole lean into serving, not selling. I completely stole this from David Cancel of HubSpot and now Drift fame. But basically the concept is if you're engineering product, sales, marketing for happier and loyal customers, high growth comes. So that's the first thing. If you're truly helping people, delivering a ton of value, that growth is going to come. There's a reason Apple has the highest NPS score on a product ever, which either 89 or 93, I can't remember at the moment. So that's kind of the first part. The second part is learning more about your customers than they know themselves. And the third is applying that in a high tempo testing or an experiment driven growth type of way. So the second part in terms of customer insight and how we can make those ads better, assuming we're focusing on those ads. So that's anything from running surveys, both to an email list or in-app type surveys, to it can be UX. Most importantly, there's lots of different ways. Honestly, just even organizing customer feedback coming from customer support the right way and keeping it centralized is customer interviews. Mm-hmm. Done well. A lot of people, I find, think they know their customers, and they do to some degree, but your customers and your market shift over time, especially as you grow. So really paying attention, I make people, depending on how successful they are, how great their company is doing, I make the C-levels do customer interviews at least every 2 weeks because they're incredibly valuable.
My question was, the prepared question was, who is supposed to be doing the interviews? I guess your answer is like everybody, especially the executives.
Yeah, so everyone should be doing them. If everyone is doing them, it becomes an organizational issue because the most important thing is that they're not siloed. So let's say you have, it depends on the size of the company, but if you had a growth team, obviously the growth team would be doing it. I'd still make the C-level do them. And, there's other different, if you're big enough, you have a user research department, of course, but let's assume you're not big enough to have a whole user research department yet. But you have your growth team, or you have your marketing team, you have your sales team, you have your engineers, and I make everyone do them. If there is a growth team or someone responsible for growth, they would be doing the majority of them. But it's very important for everyone to be doing them. And if I'm speaking to anyone else who is in growth, sometimes, you know, there's a battle or marketing. There is a battle between engineering and growth and marketing about what needs to be done and what needs to be prioritized. And I am by no means an expert on that. But in terms of getting everyone involved and hearing the evidence firsthand can make a tremendous difference. So then the challenge becomes, if you get everyone on board to do these interviews, and we do the training to make sure we're doing interviews the right way, because again, it's really similar to like running a trial, right? You know, you can't ask leading questions. You have to structure the questions in such a way that are going to bring out the information that you want without being leading or without biasing the results. So in order to get everyone together, and once you do that, you need to have a system. And so one of the systems I generally recommend is, obviously, we, you know, honestly, when you're doing a customer interview, we do 4 or 5 questions, because the most important part of the interview comes from the follow-up. It's not the questions. I hardly ever get through all my questions when I'm doing them personally. No one I know who I coach or train ever gets through them all. It's all in the follow-up. If anyone's heard of the Toyota 5 Whys framework, but basically, when someone gives you an answer, typically, if anything, it's, you know, a symptom, not a root cause. Like, think if you went to the doctor, for instance, and you said you had a headache. Well, is that enough for the doctor to be able to diagnose you and help you? No, because that's a symptom. That's not the root cause. The root cause could be anything from allergies to a brain injury, to a head injury, to something horrific like cancer, to stress, to all of these different things. So they have to ask why or tell me more. And so it's the same thing when you're asking questions. You have these 4 or 5 questions, and like one of my favorite, you know, questions is, you know, if it's a product that they've already used and they're a current customer, is tell me how you use X today. You're going to ask so many follow-up questions to that. Oh, that's really interesting. Tell me more. Oh, that's fascinating. Tell me, you know, I'd really like to learn more about that. Oh, I wasn't quite sure about that. Do you mind clarifying that? And those one question can sometimes last a 20 or 30 minute interview, because it can take you down that rabbit hole. Your job is to really play doctor and get from a symptom to the root cause, or a detective. So starting with, you know, I kind of got off on a little tangent there on best practices for doing interviews. But, you know, have a similar set of questions. Everyone gets the right training. And then I recommend that all the interviews are recorded. Again, depending on where you are, you need to check with different levels of consent with your legal team. And I always, as a general best practice, say to the person I'm interviewing, I normally record these interviews just because I want to pay attention to you and have a really great conversation. And that way my assistant can type up notes later. Do you mind if I record this? And typically the answer is yes. Sometimes it's not. So if the answer is yes, I get them get them recorded, and then I get them, the whole team, to get them all transcribed. Now, you can find a transcriber on Upwork, or you can use something like rev.com. Unfortunately, transcription is still quite expensive, but it's still worth it to do. And then there's one person in charge of correlating all the feedback and all the insight and doing the analysis that is then spread out to the whole team.
That was one of my questions. How do you actually analyze those? Because even when transcribed, which is a big task and expensive task by itself, it's still a wall of text. So there is someone sitting down and reading that all and, you know, extracting insights from that.
Yes, absolutely. I call that your chief customer advocate officer.
Okay.
Wonderful. Yes. Yes. So typically, again, let's say you're working at a typical, let's say, SaaS company. I like to work in the Series A, Series B range generally. So you can have a team anywhere between, let's say, 20 and 200 people. Generally less than 200. Generally, you're working like out of, say, 20 to 100 employees. And then in that case, usually someone of the growth team would be designated that. I believe, and one of the things that I'm working on evangelizing, is the role of the chief customer advocate officer as a C-level executive. But for most right now, that role gets worn by someone on the growth team. And so in terms of analyzing, so there's a couple, lots of tricks to doing this. But yeah, you're right. This is what stops a lot of people. If people are collecting this information at all, and if they're doing it right, you know, asking the right type of questions, doing it in a way that's not going to bias their data so it has integrity and all of those things, the next step, what happens is it never gets used because the analysis is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about a few tricks for that then. So when I do it and how I coach people to do it, the first thing I like to do And I like just to take a read through the whole interview, the transcript. And I prefer to do them in bulk, because if you start to do them individually after each, let's say you're personally doing them, then you're going to start biasing yourself for other interviews you're doing, because typically you batch interviews, depending on whether there's a KPI you really need to improve on, or they're just part of a regular ongoing customer program, which I recommend. Either way, you're batching them together. So you look through them. That's first pass. I just kind of look through, get an idea of what was said. The second time I go through, I start highlighting. That's things that interest me, whether it's from a copy or a messaging perspective, or it's a very interesting insight. And if I've already read some few others, then I'm going to start to see some trends, or if it's a trend. So that's typically the second step for how I like to do my analysis of these interviews. Now, I also recommend using a tool, Get4Eyes. It's a free survey tool. I shouldn't say free. Pretty low. So if you're doing an actual survey, I like to use that because you can use some data mining features that are usually enterprise if you're doing a survey. But if you're just doing an actual customer interview, the next step is to really export it to a customer, to a spreadsheet. And so, sorry?
Yes, absolutely. We talked before and you recommended Get4Eyes. I've been quite impressed by their feature set, and most of it is available for free. Big deal.
Yes, free. Free is really good. I really like free.
And for the inner designer that's inside me, they have a very pretty UI. It's not as innovative as Typeform, for example.
No, it's not.
It's traditional, but that's good because it's traditional. Because not everyone likes all these creative forms.
No, exactly. So honestly, so I do my I love Get4Eyes, and I have a tendency to go off on little tangents, so I'm just trying to bring it back to customer interview analysis before I can get on a survey analysis tangent, but I do really like Get4Eyes. SurveyMonkey Premium has some good contextual analysis features too, but the data mining features from Get4Eyes are pretty good and either free or very cheap compared to what you pay for them anywhere else. So with customer interviews, I do my second pass. And then I start reading all of the survey. After I've done my two passes, I then do the next one. And then I do the next one and the next one. Again, because we batch these. So I'm looking through 10, I'm looking through 20, I'm looking through 30, whatever the number is. And so after I've done reading them, I have a good idea of the things that keep coming up again and again and again. And because I've highlighted those interesting insights, I can quickly go back a third time and really make some notes on what the trends or patterns are. And that's it. Like when you're looking through these, you're looking for two things. You're looking for trends and patterns, and you're looking for copy messaging. And usually the two are intertwined to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So it's no easy feat, really. You have to sit down and spend a few hours reading those.
Absolutely. There's some tricks to doing it. If surveys make it a little bit easier, and you can put it in a spreadsheet, which I mentioned, depending on what type of interview you do. But honestly, I use spreadsheets a lot for surveys. I definitely don't really use them for interviews. I keep the transcript the way it is. Now, for pattern recognition, I'll kind of keep track in one column. Let's say I notice that all the customers seem to be talking about
something,
and I'll like put it in the first. Sorry, I'm trying to think of a good example, but nothing came. So I'll put that in the first column, and then every time I see it happen again, I'll put like in the second column right next to a B column. You know, I'll update the number. So we'll put a one in the first time I see it again. I'll put in a two. See it again. I'll put in a three. So that way I can keep track of those trends and patterns. But honestly, you can also just do that on a pen and paper or a Word document. Spreadsheets are great for surveys, but there's no cheat with customer interviews. There's a few tools trying to help with some AI, but you just got to read through them. I recommend reading all of them first time briefly, just to get an idea the first time. Each individual, do the first one, read it briefly. Second time, you do it more in depth. Again, this is each individual one, and you do highlighting. And then you do that for all of them. And then you go back and do a skim the third time, which you do them all in whatever order you want. and you really look for those trends and patterns because you've already had an idea. And I recommend sitting down and doing this and walling off time to do this and doing this all at once.
I would like to ask a question about actual terms. And does content marketing somehow relate to organic growth, or is it more a question of just improving the user journey throughout from the top to the bottom of the funnel?
So just to make sure I understand the question, I wouldn't say content marketing and organic growth. Content marketing is a marketing tactic, specifically. So organic growth principles, and again, will help make your content marketing more effective from not only the topics you talk about and how you write it and discovering new ways to distribute your content, because you're doing this deep work required by organic growth, which is really learning about your customers, I say, better than they know themselves. But no, the two are separate. So the content marketing is inbound in terms of people are throwing up their hands and saying, yes, I'm interested, and you're not cold emailing them or cold calling them. Mm-hmm. But organic growth is really about more holistic view about the whole customer journey and developing that sustainable growth, which it's not tactic specific.
Mm-hmm. So that probably originates from my initial lack of knowledge between marketing and growth teams. One of them is inbound and the other is outbound.
So I would have probably maybe a slightly different definition of what a growth versus a marketing team is. So a growth team, like a Facebook growth team or a Dropbox growth team or an Airbnb growth team or any growth team that you want, basically what they do is that they're in charge of the whole funnel. Kind of think of them or the head of the growth team, the VP of growth, can also be called chief revenue officer. That's assuming, again, we're talking about SaaS and revenue is the ultimate goal. And if you're a consumer app platform, that can differ a little bit, but let's stick with SaaS because I know that's mostly your audience. And they're in charge of the whole funnel, whether that's product, whether that's marketing, whether that's customer success. They're looking at that whole customer funnel or that whole customer journey, and they're looking for the highest prioritization points, and then they're running experiments on those prioritization points. They lead that. But then you have your individual marketing team, customer success team, and the best growth teams would have representatives from your sales team, your marketing team, and your customer success teams on the growth team as well, and they would be involved in the growth team meetings. So think of them as, I call business growth rate optimization. That's what their focus is, whereas marketing would be the individual one responsible for doing some of the tasks and the larger marketing initiatives like content marketing.
Thank you for this explanation. I think it's vital because a lot of us, myself included, we come from, the bootstrapped ecosystem where we cannot afford the luxury of those multiple teams. So it's all in one and it's hard to differentiate the features and the functions.
It's really hard. It really is hard. And the bigger that you get, the harder it gets to kind of go backwards either. But if the biggest thing I can kind of recommend, whether you're bootstrapped and small or big, is it's an interdisciplinary effort. Like think about the silos between what you might have, even if you have a small team of like five or six, between engineering or marketing or engineering and sales or engineering and product. You guys are all ultimately working towards the same goal, revenue optimization, right? Mm-hmm. So those silos actually just lead to ineffective resource allocation. When you're all focused on one goal as a team and breaking down those silos, that's how you're going to achieve generally your best growth results because you're going to have more effective resource allocation.
Thank you. This is great. My next question is about KPIs and measuring them. I would love to have your take on how analytics needs to be run in a SaaS company. And I would probably say in a small SaaS company because big SaaS companies have already figured it out and we're not working for them.
Yes, some of their analytics infrastructures, are just, crazy. Analytics are, I talk a lot about contextual data only because, I shouldn't say only because, one of the reasons because is because hardly anyone talks about it. There's a lot of people talking about analytics and like high tempo testing and growth process, which these are all part of the bigger picture together. But analytics tells you what happened and the contextual tells you the why. But you also need to know what happened so you can measure whether something's working or not working. So the analytics piece is incredibly important. For a small team, generally what I recommend is you need to start with an analytics tracking plan. It is the most boring thing ever. Nobody wants to do it. But it's incredibly important for so many reasons, and I'll tell you a couple of them. So the first reason is that if you don't have a tracking plan, no one knows what the individual events you're tracking are, right? If you say signed up, what does that mean? Does that mean they signed up to be a paid customer? Does that mean they signed up to a trial? Does that mean they signed up to an email list? All of these different definitions, and guarantee the person who said, hey, make an event. So if anyone, you know, generally, I'm assuming most people know how analytics works. If you're working with any product-based analytics, which if you're a SaaS company, I definitely recommend you do. The kind of the big platforms are Amplitude, Kissmetrics, Woopra, and Mixpanel. And Heap Analytics, I know Janie used that too, has been kind of an up-and-comer, which is easier out of the box, but doesn't let you get into the level of detail of something, let's say, an Amplitude or a Mixpanel would. I'm personally a fan of Amplitude, but any of those products will do the job, is you need to write event tracking code. So you really need to get this planned out and have an exact definition of what that event signifies. Because when you're building out your funnels, you're looking at your retention curves, you need to know how you're building those out and what exactly those mean. Because guaranteed, I've seen 80% of the time, someone thinks they mean something and the person implemented it thought it meant something different. And so they're looking at data that's just completely wrong. So that's the first thing, is to make sure you're collecting good quality data. Because what I say, what's worse than not collecting data at all is, because at least you know you're not collecting data, is thinking you're collecting good data when really you're not. That's even more dangerous than not collecting data at all.
Let me interrupt you for a second, just to translate it into real life world. So you take a piece of paper, it's a Word document, write down what kind of events you're going to be tracking, put together your funnel just on paper first, and then you take that to your developer and set up your analytics in the way that everything is tracked correctly.
Yes. And the way it works is a lot of these tools, you can create funnels, any type of funnel you want, but it's all based on these events. So you need to think about every possible event that you want to track. Let's say that's viewed homepage, not a user, clicked sign up button, completed sign up button. You know, all of these different things need to be individually tracked as events in order to build the funnels and the retention analysis curves and all of that stuff that you want to use within the tools. So think about it that way. You have to think about every possible micro step that could lead to any one of the things that you want to measure. So often an analytics tracking plan, like most analytics, even starting out, like if you can measure 10 important things, I'd rather you do that and do it well and do it right. But generally, like you'll be tracking like easy 30 to 50 things.
Ooh, that's a lot.
That's why I'm saying if we can start with just 10, if I can get you doing 10 right, so we can trust the data and work with them, start with 10. But generally, like there's a lot of things you'll want to measure. So you'll work your way up to, let's say, 30 or 50 for a small, you know, just general run-of-the-mill SaaS.
Okay. Going back to your initial train of thought. Step number one is putting together your analytics tracking plan. And what's the next step?
So the next step would be obviously getting it implemented. By engineering, typically, that's who needs to do the implementation or the writing of the custom tracking code. Of course, I recommend, and I should also explain this too, I like to use Google Analytics as well. I didn't mention that originally, but if you're a SaaS, you need to have product-based analytics, and those are the Woopras and the Amplitudes and the mixed panels that I just mentioned. That tells you more what happens in product, but there's a few things that only Google Analytics can tell you about your website or your marketing site. So obviously, I recommend using that as well. And there's a few other tools. I particularly like using something like FullStory or Hotjar. FullStory basically is, putting it in an easy way, user journey UX recordings to the extreme. So think of something like you would do with it, user testing, and take it to the extreme with FullStory because it allows you to organize and categorize. Love FullStory. As well as using, you know, something like Hotjar for heat maps and all that stuff for your website. That's kind of just a basic analytics stack. So get that implemented. And then third, you have to have someone who's monitoring it again on a weekly basis because you can have it all implemented. But if you're not using any of that data to basically generate better ideas to test out, then there's no point in doing it.
What are the KPIs that we're looking at? The typical classic software metrics. Not that I don't know some of them, but a recap from you would be delightful.
Sure. So I'm not sure if anyone, I guess, has talked about North Star metrics on your podcast, Jane, but I'll kind of just quickly delve into that. So in terms of KPIs, the best advice that I can give is that you need to determine one for the whole company, not an individual team, the whole company. And it needs to be one that's aligned with the value you deliver. So obviously the biggest KPI, your SaaS company, MRR. You want to increase your MRR or ARR, depending on how you're structured. That's really important, and that's ultimately how you're going to measure success. But when you think about a KPI to optimize for growth around, again, coming back to sustainable growth, unicorn-like growth, is going to come back to happier, loyal customers. How do you measure happier, loyal customers? The value they get out of the product. So I recommend don't go with all these different KPIs. You know, set up your customer funnel, customer journey, have your five steps, have them defined, acquisition, activation, retention, etc. I'm sure all of you have heard that before. But then you need to pick, and this is the biggest one, pick one metric to focus the whole company around. Not 20, not 10, not 3, one. And for a SaaS company, this shouldn't be MRR, because that's a lagging indicator. That tells you what happened. But you need something that's going to be a leading indicator of that MRR growth that everyone wants. So think about, like, for Facebook, I like to use Facebook as an example because everyone uses Facebook and most people I know would like some Facebook-worthy growth, is for the longest time, the only metric that mattered was user growth. That's it. Nothing else. And I'm talking like 2007, 2010, 2011, like a very long time, user growth.
That is headcount, actual headcount of users.
Not headcount of users, daily active users is how they would define it. Because again, you come back to value delivered. Mm-hmm. You need to measure, again, if we want that sustainable hypergrowth, we have to come back to creating happy, loyal customers. So therefore, it has to be related to value delivered. So theirs would be, it gets very complicated, but basically how many users were active a certain number of days out of the last 28 days was how they measured user growth.
Yeah, here is a very good example. See, I'm not very professional in this area, so I said just headcount, and you were saying how this metric works specifically reflecting the value.
Yes, so there's user growth in terms of getting people to sign up, but then there's user growth that's going to be ultimately the KPI, the best indicator for, you know, overall optimization of a company, and that would be that daily active user growth that Facebook was after. And again, I didn't work at Facebook. I'm just using this as an example. So it could be slightly off from what they actually did, but I'm just using it as an example because everyone would understand. So user growth would be one thing. Let's get to 10 million, 100 million, a billion users. But more importantly, if we're going to make money or if we're going to do whatever, they need to be on Facebook using Facebook in order for us to do any of those things. Therefore, we're going to measure user growth, not only in terms of how many users we get, because that's important, but how many of them are active for Facebook, I believe, from people I heard and what I know, would be daily active users.
This principle is actually, you can see it in a lot of business books in different kind of, variations when the company focuses on just one aspect, and that should be reflected in the KPI that you're measuring.
Exactly. So, take it back to, MRR, take it back to like that example in terms of picking a KPI. Again, if you're SaaS, MRR is the output. That's what you want. So you have to find something. So the question I ask people as we're trying to figure out what this North Star metric could be, and I can give you a few examples of a few famous companies of what they're reported to be and what we all talk about, just to kind of help people because I find examples are very helpful, is I ask, if you knew nothing else about what your users or your customer did with your product and you need to know if you were delivering value, what is the one thing that you would want to know? And that's a question I ask because that gets people thinking, well, if I can only find out one thing and I had to know if they were getting value from the product, what would I look at? And that kind of gets you thinking as to down the right train of thought as to what this North Star metric that indicates value received could be. So for just to give you a few examples, Airbnb would be number of nights booked, right? Because that's the more nights, if they book more nights, they're getting more value out of the product. That's going to be reflected in, of course, revenue, which is the most important thing for that type of company and for almost any SaaS company.
A very popular business example is, for example, hotel chain focusing on the quality of sleep. And if they were a SaaS company, they would pick a metric, KPI, tracking, for example, number of hours well slept, then go all the way down to improving that number, right?
Yes, that would be similar, yes.
Okay, thank you. This is really, really awesome. I think we need to wrap up today's episode because we've been talking for a while, even though it can last for another couple hours, I think.
Yes, oh, I did go off on a little tangent there about customer interviews.
So, if you were to give a piece of advice to those who are just starting out and want to, you know, master organic growth in their small SaaS product, what would be your top few tips for them?
My top few tips for organic growth is I would start, let's say start number one, I would start measuring NPS. While NPS is far from your perfect measure and there's a lot of problems with it, it's one of the best ones we have right now. You can use something like Delighted to measure it. It's a great product. Or you can just do it using a survey mechanism like SurveyMonkey or Get4Eyes or anything like that. But that would be the number one thing.
Can you please clarify what that stands for?
Sure, sorry. NPS is Net Promoter Score. And basically it asks a question. It says, how likely would you be to recommend this to X? While I have a lot of problems generally about asking questions that have to do with future behavior, again, we're just going to go with this for because it does work pretty well. And then it asks people to do it on a scale of 1 to 10. Again, normally something I recommend not doing, but we're putting all that aside for this. And it says not very likely at one end and very likely at the other. And then you score people based on their answers. So 9 and 10 would be promoters, and then you have your detractors, and then you have your passives. And basically you measure your score. It does a calculation, but more or less what it is it measures your promoters minus your detractors, and it comes up with a score. And you obviously want that score. If you can get your score above 50, that's where you really want to see. 30 is okay. And a lot of SaaS companies will be at 30, and that's good, but you really want to get to above 50. You have Jason Lumpkin, you know, from Saster and all of that. You know, he's on a big NPS kick right now, and he's basically saying, if you don't have an NPS score of above 50, I will not invest in you. And that's part of the larger trend we're seeing. But most importantly, in terms of measuring that as a benchmark, the second thing is the follow-up. So then you need to ask them, what is the single most important reason for your answer above? And that's an open-ended question. And that is a gold mine from anything from product to marketing to messaging to customer insight. So that's kind of the easiest tip. If you're not measuring that now, start measuring it. And start measuring it on an ongoing basis. You may have heard of using NPS to measure the effectiveness of, let's say, customer support. But again, getting back to this holistic, big picture optimization of the whole company around one goal and creating happier, more loyal customers, whether that's from product or marketing or sales or support, is what's going to lead to sustainable hypergrowth, that it needs to be used from the whole company perspective, not just a customer support perspective.
This is gold. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And the second, I'll just kind of rattle off a few other kind of quick tips. Mm-hmm. So the second one would be, I talked a lot about, and I did go down that tangent a little bit on customer interviews. We didn't get a chance to really talk about surveys, would be, how much do you invest in developing willing and successful customers? Chances are you spend the majority of your resources on product, marketing, sales, et cetera, which is great. It's how everyone does it. But think about, flip it around for a little bit. Whatever you invest in developing willing and successful customers or users, that is going to have an amplifying effect on everything else you do in product, marketing, or sales. Yet it's usually has the least amount of resources devoted to it. So I say, invest a little bit more in that, even if it's 1% or doubling what you have already, which is very little. Invest in that. Talk to your customers. Figure out what problems they're having. Figure out how they're using the product. Figure out what they're trying to achieve. Those three things alone will be tremendously valuable, again, across every silo of your company. Not support, not product, not marketing, not sales, all of them. So do those things. Run the NPS. Hop on the phone, do a few interviews, even if you just ask those three questions. That is fantastic. And the third, take advantage of tools, you know, like Fullstory. Take advantage of tools like Hotjar. If you're not asking people, you know, why they, you know, after they signed up, for instance, for a trial, what almost stopped you from signing up, take advantage of doing some of those really quick, easy customer insight wins. Organize customer feedback coming in through customer support into things that are UX issues or marketing issues, and just organize them into a spreadsheet. David Cancel has a great framework for that. It's called Spotlight. Just Google it. But if you do those three things, organize your customer feedback, use some of these tools, make sure you have your analytics set up properly, and use tools like Hotjar and FullStory, and start measuring NPS and using what you learn from NPS across your whole company to generate better ideas from product to marketing and better prioritization of ideas, you'd be so much further ahead than most people.
Thank you. I hope I'm not interrupting any other train of thought.
Thank you. I'm done.
I can just keep saying thank you and thank you once again.
Yes.
Any great reading?
Yeah. So a few things I really like. Heat and Shaw did a book called 5 Habits for Better Products. I highly, highly, highly recommend that. David Cancel also did a book recently called Hypergrowth, which again, he talks about the importance of talking to your customers, which perhaps didn't come through as much today, but bottom line is the more you talk to your customers, the more sustainable growth you're going to have. No matter how you talk to them or how you listen to them, the more you do it, the more success in terms of hypergrowth you're going to have. And David Cancel did a whole book that includes that as well and how he organizes engineering and product teams. And that's a great book as well. In terms of analytics, Lean Analytics is a good book that I really like. Hooked by Nir Yell. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, so if he's listening and I butchered it, I apologize, or to anyone who knows him.
I saw him speaking. He says cereal, so he's Nir Yell.
Nir Yell, okay.
Cereal.
Cereal, Nir Yell. Okay, thank you. Now I can mark that for future reference. And I really like Dan Pink's To Sell as Human. That's another great book because it really talks about the importance of the theory of lean into serving, not selling, and listening to your customers. He talks about it in a different framework, but the same kind of message will come through. So those are just some quick books that I really enjoy and highly recommend.
Great. Where can people find your work online?
Yes, they can find it at instratify.co, instratify.co. And I'm going to do a cheat sheet based on everything we've talked about today, some questions to ask. I think that will be the most actionable cheat sheet. And I know it's a question I get asked all the time for your listeners. So if they want to go to instratify.co/UI breakfast, then I will have a cheat sheet for you there. You can read my blog, sign up for my email list. You know all that. And if you just have any questions or feedback, feel free to email me at ashley@instratify.co. I love to hear from people.
Thank you so much. This is fantastic. This is so packed with valuable insight.
Minus my little tangent there. I hope so.
Because as doers, we're always focused on product and we always have no clue how to extract those insights. And your advice was exactly about that.
Yeah. And I did. And I know we didn't get a chance to talk about surveys, but I just did a workshop on survey methodology, which I can probably send you the link to as well for the podcast notes, because that will get into some of the analysis of surveys as well, which, you know, would be more spreadsheet based, which people can parse, which I know people love to parse content and parse data. I get it. So I can link that up as well.
Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your wisdom. It was great.
Thank you so much for having me again. I'm honored and I really enjoyed this.
Wonderful. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.